Hey everyone, welcome to Gods of Eden. Today's guest is Tambo Solovwe. I was introduced to Tambo through a men's mental health group, which is called Mentally, and it's a platform that I really, really love and have taken great value from. And I think the first thing that struck me about Tambo was that he was funny, he was welcoming, I felt extremely comfortable in his presence, and there was just a real engaging and intriguing side to him, because as we began to engage in topics that were deeper and darker and more serious when it comes to mental health, he had a level of sensitivity and wisdom that I was really drawn to, because it was kind of this contradiction of someone extremely lighthearted and funny whilst also being sensitive and wise and being able to engage in some tougher topics. So I immediately was drawn to him in that sense, because I found him extremely interesting, and he ended up becoming someone that is one of my favorite people to talk to and engage with in just in a multitude of topics, but just someone I've always really valued the time that I've spent around him. So when it came to this conversation, I was extremely excited. I was just really looking forward to learning more about Tambo, and it leads to this phenomenal conversation that you're about to hear. Tambo was born and raised in Zambia, and I think that was just a trip in its own, being able to see Tambo speak about Africa and how the societal stereotype can be that we perceive Africa as purely poverty, and Tambo goes into why that wasn't the case for his childhood. And then being able to take that and be raised in London with his brothers and his mum, it was just great to hear him talk about it all. And Tambo's now gone on to not only the work that he does with Mentally, but he's also a director and founder of his drama company called Flourish. And he's doing a lot of fantastic coaching work in terms of helping people with the way that they present and speak to audiences. So just a truly sensational person. I cannot say enough about him as what he represents as a man and as a human being. And I just can't wait for you to hear the conversation. So without further ado, 3, 2, 1, let's go. Hey, Tambo, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good, bro. I'm real, real, real good. Like, hey.
Right, first question. Tambo, can you give me a song that reminds you of a good memory or just makes you feel happy?
So, I love this question. And I had a whole bunch of, because I'm a muso, so I love music, I love listening to music. And my first, the one thing that came to mind straight away was Crisscross Jump, when I was about 5, 6, maybe even younger. And then I remember wearing my jeans backwards and trying to wear my trainers backwards, but realizing that you can't wear trainers backwards. But I do remember wearing my jeans backwards. I had a polo top. It was a Gap hoodie or something like that. And I wore that backwards. And then that song came on, and I was just like, that was my official introduction to hip hop. And I was just like, this is dope. Like, these young kids jumping on stage. I even remember the MTV performance. And I was just like, this is dope. And that was me back in Zambia when I was there, little kid. Yeah. So the moment that you said, song that gives me a memory, boom, that hit straight away.
I love that, man. They really had that. They really had that, like, going strong. The backwards, like, chains and that.
Everything, and it was so funny, and it was so dumb, because obviously when you need to go to the toilet, like, how the hell is that? You have to pull your trousers down. But it was great, man, going strong, the backwards jacket, the backwards jumper, and when you see the way they were rocking their stuff, I was just like, this is who I want to be. And obviously, that's where the idea of America became such a big influence in, like, the culture, the way that I talk, the way that I dress, growing up in Zambia and stuff like that. And I was just like, this is the guy. Like, this is it. These two are the guys.
I love that, man. So that is going to live on the Gods of Eden soundtrack Spotify playlist. Ooh. Tambo's up in there. I love that. So, born and raised in Zambia.
Yeah,
I found that super interesting. What was a young Tambo like? And I've heard you explain the Zambia life, and then of course when you transition to moving here, and I'm not going to say anymore because you explain it really well. So can you explain what the childhood was like in Zambia?
So it's hilarious. Whenever I say this to people, I always, it's funny. It's only when I've got here where I find, I hear that sounds really arrogant, but I grew up in Zambia in a very affluent home. So you'd imagine maids, big house, going to private school, a driver, all of that stuff. And so growing up in Zambia, I just remember that's why I think about Crisscross, and we had like MTV because we had like two living rooms, one for the kids and one for the adults and stuff like that. And like we had like, when I say maids, it sounds really arrogant, but we had like people that would look after us. And my mom worked and so did my dad. And they did really well for themselves. And it was just an interesting experience knowing the narrative that and the picture that people have of Zambia or Africa when you come to the Western world. Or when you come to like the UK, people just think like it's so small. And obviously over the last few years, people have completely expanded their thinking. But when you think about the 90s, came to the UK in 94. Uh-huh. And at that point, it's just kind of like, oh, you have a strange accent. Oh, like you come from Africa. Like you I'm just going to say it, you African boo-boo. Like that's what people, oh, you're an African boo-boo and all of that stuff. And I'm just like, wait, hold on. I don't live in Mudhat. Like we lived in a really big house.
Yeah.
And I remember moving. So my mum and dad, they got divorced. And when they got divorced, it was funny. I was listening to one of your guests and they talked about how the separation of their parents didn't affect them. But for me, I think it only in my later life when I realized how the separation of my mom and dad affected me. And even when my dad passed away in 2018, going back to see him and seeing everything that he had built up, completely realized how the trajectory of my life was impacted by that divorce. And so it's like coming from this big house with maids and eating whatever I want and having a driver to coming to London, living in a council flat with like with my auntie and like my cousins, and it was like a 3-bedroom, and there was like 6 of us in the 3-bedroom. Seven of us. Like my mom and my mom and my auntie. My mom brought her 3 boys, 2 boys at that time, and then my auntie also had her 3 kids, and we're just in this flat, and I was just like, this is not what I remember. This is not what I thought London was gonna be like. You know what I mean? I thought my whole lifestyle that I was living in Zambia would be transferred to the UK. So I would have like this big house in Chelsea with like a driver, and rather than maids and servants, we'd call them butlers. And do you know what I mean? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the case. And so it was a huge cultural shock in regards to understanding how different life was going to be. And I think it took, it's only as I got older, I realized that adjustment was relatively difficult for me because I didn't enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Especially because we came at the end of summer. So we came September, just started school. So I came August, got into school September, and realizing the educational system was completely different. Mm. And I was just like, this is not cool. Like, I didn't adjust. It took me a while to adjust, but it was just the transition was difficult to manage. And so that's literally the two pictures that was painted for me.
Yeah, it is so interesting, right, that there's just this like, Western opinion of what Africa's like. So when I heard you kind of go into it, I was like, oh shit, like you've given this like completely different perspective of what like growing up in Africa's like. I found it so insightful, like hearing you talk about it.
And I think it's really interesting because the reason why is because till this day, I think now we've become more accustomed to seeing the affluent African, but from the perspective of they have really big mansion houses. But I was like, was I well off? Yes. But it wasn't kind of to the point where we had like 6 or 7 cars and this big mansion house. But it was, we had enough space and enough of everything to live. I think now I'd be considered very middle class. If the equivalent, it would be a very middle class upbringing. In regards to like equivalent from Africa and the UK, I was just a very middle class kid. And so that in itself, understanding the African middle class and what that looks like is something that I think we need to develop our thinking on. And also just as the world globalization takes hold and us expanding our view of what the world looks like, it's the idea that yes, there is extreme poverty, but there's also extreme poverty here in the UK. When you actually think about people living below the breadline and stuff like that, it's like, okay, cool. Now, imagine in places that are not as developed, but you see the disparity between the two, it's clear. And so, yeah, man, it's one of my things. It's so funny. I always say the one thing that I want to do is change the perception of Africa and how people perceive Africa to be. Because if I show slums in Africa, I could definitely show some slums like in London. Like I've been to Enns, do you know what I mean? I grew up on Enns. So I could actually show like people living on the street and I was like, okay, cool. But then it's funny, it's not funny, but it's interesting. The parallel that my uncle would always say is that the difference between being poor in Europe and being poor and in Africa is that at least you can walk to a tree and there might be food on that tree. Whereas in here in the UK, like they, you look and it's like, I'm going to have to steal or I'm going to have to beg for it. But the worst comes to worst with people that in Africa, they just need to find somewhere where there's a tree or a bush or something like that. And they can live off the land in that respect. So it's really interesting opinions in the way that you see it.
Super interesting. Really interesting. And yeah, so tough transition, which like is completely normal. And then how do you look back now? As in, like you said, like maybe the transition was tougher than I had initially thought. How did that manifest? Like, how did that, in what ways did maybe your behavior or kind of the emotional, maybe like, you know, the hardening emotionally at like such a young age, like how did it manifest the, like the struggles with that transition as you were growing up?
That's really interesting. I remember two significant moments were the first time that I was stepped into a classroom. And this was when I realized that I was different. It was the first time I stepped in the classroom and most of the people in that room, I went to a very mixed school, by the way, but most of the people in that room were white. And even I was like, oh, okay, this is different. And I think at that time I was just like, this is different, but I don't see any difference to who you are. But then the kids started treating me differently simply because of the way I spoke. And that's the whole, the African bubu thing, that whole, and I was, and then I remember being that age thinking, okay, I need to get rid of my accent as soon as possible. And I don't know, like it was weird because I saw them, it's like, and the way it worked or the way it registered was they're black kids in my class, but they don't talk to them funny and they don't make fun of them. But then they make fun of me because I'm African. Okay, I'm going to hide my African identity by getting rid of my accent. And I'm going to sound as English and prim as proper as soon as possible in order to fit in quicker. And then I remember really struggling to fit in regards to the way that I spoke and the way that I said things. And then the one thing that I was really good at was that I was fast, I was athletic, and I could play football. So the moment that I started playing football and I was athletic, I got acceptance from the lads. And then once the lads accepted me, I was like, yeah, this is shooing. And then I just remember... I remember being, I don't know how long that period was, but I just remember in second primary school, shout out to Stephanie White, because I'm going to put her on blast, I don't care if you even, but anyway, she was like one of the first girls that I had the biggest crush on, but she was like this pretty, and that's obviously, she's still an attractive lady now, but it was just like looking at her and just thinking like, wow, she's really pretty, but she won't like me because I'm African. Does it make sense? And that, again, meant that I began to overcompensate. So areas where I was really good. So let's talk about athletics, presentation, singing, the like dancing, and being able to articulate myself well, despite having a slight accent. It was the idea that I was really going to excel in that and push that so that I gained acceptance. But what I realized is that that had a negative effect in some areas. So because of the fact that I'm African, why should you be able to speak better than us? Do you know what I mean? Because you're African, why should you be able to sing better than us? And so it was that ideology that took ages to break, and then it manifested in different ways as I got older, which was me embracing my blackness, embracing my identity of what it means to actually be black. Like, it's more than, and the cultural awareness of who I am now, all of that has been a long journey. And when I think about key points as well, so final thought, when I think about key points, especially in regards to behavior, just picking that up, I remember being in secondary school and going to, again, a majority mixed school. But this time was majority Asian and like Pakistani, Bangladeshi, that kind of environment, with also Kosovan. So it's very like, you know, that kind of your side of the world. And it was in Edgware Road. So imagine what Edgware Road is like. Do you know what I mean? So that mixture of people. And then at that point, being black again was the minority and being white was a minority in that school. So if you're black or white, you're a complete minority. And then how it manifested was me really saying, yeah, I'm black and what? So I'll be dropping the N-word every now and then. I'll be listening to Tupac. I would overemphasize every single stereotype that you can think of, from being, what's the tie-in? From listening to Criss Cross and being like, jump, Biggie and Tupac and DMX and being like, this is who I am. If you want to mess with me, this is going to be a whole completely different story. And so that, again, molded a lot of my ideology and a lot of my thinking. But obviously, as I got older, I realized that that needs to be tempered in a way that is actually non- it doesn't always have to be as threatening as it comes across, but also understanding that people's perception of you is determined by how you perceive yourself.
It's a bit like a pendulum, right? In terms of going from like kind of trying to hide your blackness and kind of the African side of yourself and trying to and trying to, and then to go into secondary school and be like, oh, it's swinging back. Like, you're going to have to, you're going to have to feel this now. Cause there was these years where I had to kind of hide it. And now it's like, no, I'm black and you're going to feel this. So, what was it like growing up with three brothers in London? What was it like? Come on.
Yo, the man, them and that. You can already tell. Nah, I love my brothers, man. I think it was interesting. So growing up in South London, four boys in one household, we learned not only how to mask emotion, which became a negative thing at first, but now that we're older, we've learned to embrace our emotion.
Yeah.
But also learned that you cannot, I was going to swear, but you cannot mess with any one of us in the house. Because the moment, like I always used to say, you beat my younger brother up, I'll just be like, okay, cool, I'm going to come and kick your ass.
Yeah.
But then if you beat me up, oh, well, I've got my older brother in it. He's going to come and just whoop your ass. But then my older brother will beat me up for getting beaten up in the first place. Yeah. So it was kind of... It's like, you made me have to come and fight and defend the family on, and I'm going to have to whoop your ass. but it's just the idea of, you know what, it was a beautiful thing, because I think we debunked a lot of stereotypes, but also embraced quite a few. So all of us are very four different boys. Like, my older brother is into tech, very much an introvert. Not very much an introvert. Yeah, he is an introvert, actually. Mm. But very much into tech, works in like visual audio and sound and stuff like that. So that's his expertise. He works at Google. My younger brother, who comes after me, so I'm a consultant and a coach. Younger brother that comes after me, he's now a personal trainer. Not now a personal trainer. Personal trainer, works in rehab, works like, and he works in Knightsbridge with all these amazing like celebrity clients and stuff like that. So he's a proper Chelsea boy. We call it, he's the Chelsea boy out of all of us. And then my youngest brother, he's like rolled, like he's N. Like he's N. Like, even when it's so funny when he talks like this a little bit, you get me though. Yeah. And if he's listening, he's gonna laugh because I'm mocking him and that. But it's calm, innit? It's all right. And so growing up in South London, it was interesting because my mom definitely had favored my youngest brother when we were growing up. Mm. But she taught us to be very independent. And the one thing that stops all of us, because we could have got involved in so much gang culture and all of that stuff, but it was two things that my mom consistently did. She made us pray every morning before we went to school, and pray every morning and every night, dragged us to church every Sunday, and she kept us really busy with different hobbies. Mm. So like, my older brother learned how to play keys and now plays bass. So he plays keys and bass. My mom put me in a drama class and stuff like that. So every Saturday I was always in like drama school and musical theatre, that sort of thing. My two younger brothers, every Saturday they were playing football. And if they weren't playing football, they learned how to play. Both of my younger brothers learned how to play the drums. And so it was just kind of like, my mom knew, but like we talked about this before the call, having a young mom, she knew that I need to keep these boys busy. Yeah. As much as she had energy, like sports day, she was there. Like, she was running and like all of that stuff, which was dope. And it inspired me. It's funny enough, segue. Inspired me to actually think I wanted to be a younger dad, because I remember saying, by the time I'm 21, 22, I want to have my first kid. But obviously that's not the case.
Yeah.
But it's just the idea of, it's just the idea of having a mom that was very present, but also had to work a stupid amount of hours.
Mm.
And then having four boys where we spent a lot, we built really good relationships around football, PlayStation, and all of our different hobbies.
Mm.
And then when we got into our teens, we kind of like separated. Oh, I forgot to mention this. Funny enough, I was in a Christian rap group. So me and my younger brothers, we were in a Christian rap group. And so we used to go around every weekend, like rapping in different churches, like events of up to like the biggest event that we went to was one of like 10,000 people. And we were just there rapping on stage, stuff like that, which was dope.
Wow.
Almost got nominated for a MOBO. And I say almost because that's a whole different story that I'm not going to get into. Yeah, it's crazy. Religion can actually, what does my friend say? My friend always says this, the moment that you take the truth out of the Bible, it then becomes a weapon. And I think that's when people, and I think that's applicable to any religion or the book of faith, that the moment that you take the truth out of it, the true essence of it, and then just use it as a weapon, you can use that to manipulate and destroy people's mindsets, and that's how people get hurt.
Yeah.
But anyway, park that conversation.
Yeah.
And say, it was amazing. It was amazing. And me and my brothers in our team set out to define ourselves, because we spent so much time together when we were younger that by the time we hit our teens, we were like, I'm going to do this. And we kind of scattered. But then now in our 20s, or in our probably like from mid-20s, in my mid-20s. So at that point, when my oldest brother, he got married at 20, he got married relatively young. He got married at 28, 29. Uh-huh. When he got married, that kind of made us realize, oh, frick, we're the next generation now. And there's the idea of, okay, cool. My brother's getting married. Okay, that means he's probably going to be having kids soon. That means we're going to be uncles. And we already had like nephews and nieces from cousins and stuff like that. First, second cousins. But it was the idea that that made us reflect on the type of men that we want to be and the legacy that we want to leave for our children, because our children will carry our last name. Hopefully none of our wives disagree. You know what I mean? But I'm not carrying your damn last name. Like, no, it's all right. Thank you. 2022. I am not taking your last name. Oh, but it's just the idea of that. You know what I mean? Like that idea. And what legacy can we begin to carve out for ourselves? And in order to do that, we need better relationships.
Yeah.
And so everything that our mom taught us about understanding that we are brothers, we should love each other and all of that stuff has now carried through to us in our 20s, where 20s and 30s, where we have a really good relationship. Mm-hmm. And we communicate. We have a WhatsApp group. We communicate and we meet probably every... Before it used to be like, before Rona, obviously the whole Corona thing, we're meeting once a month. But now it's like we have so much lost time to make up for. And we're just like, oh, I'm meeting you tomorrow. Oh, we're doing this, we're doing that. And just it's important to have that relationship, because your siblings are the people that you grow up with. Like you, when you enter into life, your parents are already of a certain age and your siblings like will go through every sphere and every spectrum of life with you, depending on the relationship that you have with them. Mm. And so I always laugh. I say, if you really want to get to know me, you need to get one of my brothers and two of my closest friends in a room. And then they'll tell you everything about my life. So I might tell them like 10% of the story. I might tell this other person the whole story. And I might tell this person the whole story. Yeah. Get them all three of them in the room. You've got a picture of who I am.
It's so interesting because, yeah, I imagine like kind of hearing you talk before, like before this and then, and just imagining you guys moving like from Africa, moving to London. I did imagine you as like a little team almost, like within the grand scheme of the family. And then, but to know that you guys have gone on to do like such different things, although being raised and like being such a unit, is so interesting. Like, yeah, I just find that dynamic really interesting that you guys have gone into such different professions and ways of life and everything. And then the two things that obviously come up and stick with me are growing up in the church and growing up with, I guess, religion and faith. I don't know which one you qualify as, but that being a big part of your life. And then obviously the acting and the drama side of things. I'll start with faith or religion, whichever you want to, I guess, identify as more. How has that been a big part of your life growing up in terms of like, not only it as a child, as you said, kind of that being a big thing that your mum was just like quite firm on in terms of praying, going to church on Sundays. But also like now as a man, like how it plays a part in your life in terms of having that faith in something that's bigger than everything here in the world.
Everything.
And how it's helped you not only as a child, but as an adult.
I think that's a really good question. I always say the two things, well, three things I'm really passionate about. My faith, men, in regards to like how we as men relate. So faith, men, and music. And it's like, it's so weird. But when it comes to faith, I remember, I always laugh. I say, I remember when I was five, like in Zambia. And the first thing that I ever asked for my birthday was a Bible. And my mum thought that was very weird.
Yeah.
And even till this day, I still think that's very weird. imagine a five-year-old saying, what do you want for your birthday? I want a Bible. What the frick?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, do you want like a Ninja Turtle toy or something like that? And how that carried me through life is just, it's given me a sense of hope. It's interesting because I always say I met God at religion but found him through faith. The idea that you can actually turn around and be like, yeah, this is the way imposed, because I believe that religion is imposed.
Yeah.
And it's the idea of you have to pray this amount of times a day, which my mom like thought was the best way to do it. You have to like, you can't swear, you can't drink, and you have to follow all these legalistic rules. But the more that I began to explore my faith, the more that I began to explore God, the more that I realized it's very much a personal relationship. And yes, the Bible and the principles there are exactly what they are. They're principles and they're guidelines. And you live those according to the way that you, I don't want to say you're instructed, but the way that it touches your heart and the way that you understand it. Because a lot of times what people tend to do is that they take aspects or glimpses of it and then say, okay, this is the way I want to live my life. But then you don't understand the full context and the understanding of everything, and then how it fully applies to who you are as a person. And so for me, growing up in church, knowing God, knowing Jesus, like becoming a full like Christian has helped me to really guide my morals and my principles and deciding on how I live my life. I think it's not always easy. I'll definitely say that. It's definitely not always easy. But what it does do is that it allows me to not only love, the one thing that it's allowed me to do is learn how to love people regardless of who they are, regardless of their walks of life, regardless of what they may experience or their views and their journey was. Because one of my favorite quotes is by Mahatma Gandhi, despite he was a racist, but we ain't gonna talk about that. But one of the things that he said, and I believe it was him, he said that he said, Jesus I love, but his followers I can't stand. And it's the idea that understanding that the morals and the principles that Jesus taught were absolutely phenomenal. And everyone will say that he's like the one person that's absolutely shaped and transformed this 20th century and like decades. Because we're still talking about him like 2,000 years afterwards. Do you know what I mean? And very few people we talk about consistently on a regular basis. We talk about Genghis Khan and we talk about Alexander the Great, but we talk about them in the perspective of history. But when it comes to Jesus, people talk about him presently.
Yeah.
And so for me, that informs the way that I view the world, but not only that, just the way that I live my life. And that's something we were talking before the call, funny enough, about being a father. And I say the one thing that I pray is that I can teach my child, my son, faith, or my children, faith and not religion. Because then faith will get them through anything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So them understanding universality and understanding how the laws of the world and the universe work, but also now within the confines, not confines, but within the context of who God is and how God can be seen in every single person. Because I believe that God is in everybody.
Yeah.
And all it requires is for them to awaken that part of them and actually acknowledge him and all of that stuff. But that's completely shifted who I am as a person. It's grounded me. Like, funny enough, when I went through cancer, like lymphoma, I had lymphoma and I was going through my chemo and I was going through, not chemo, whew, thank God I did it, but radiotherapy, which was before chemo. And that was really difficult. But the one thing that completely grounded me was knowing that even if I die today, I go to a better place and God is still with me. It doesn't mean that God is an evil God, because most people turn around and be like, oh my days, you like he died from cancer and he's supposed to live well and then he's God. So I'm just like, well, maybe that was the plan that God had for me in the first place.
Yeah.
But the little light that I can shine, like one of my favorite scriptures talks about that you should be a light that sat on a hill that lead like that just shines bright and stuff like that. And so for me, I think it's in Matthew. And for me, that's one of the things that I hold on to, just like being a light, being a positive energy that people can then look at. And then if they really want to get to know, it's like, why are you always happy? Why are you smiling? Oh, yeah, it's the God in me, baby. Like, it's Jesus. Yeah. Is that something? But yeah, I genuinely believe faith is important. Faith is important and it anchors you. And it's one of my core values. My values is, yeah, my faith. Yeah, so definitely.
And then the next part, acting and drama. Yeah, how did you, in terms of like, I know that your mom encouraged you to do it growing up, but of course there had to come a point where you just said, oh no, I really enjoy it and kept on doing it, right? In terms of, although your mom can maybe put you in some classes like, and say, oh, we're going to try this out. Like, if you hate it, like you hate it, like there's not much you can do in it.
So, yeah, there's not you can do that. Yeah,
but of course there probably was a time where it was like, oh no, Tambo enjoys it. Let's, you know, keep going. What did you initially enjoy about it, and kind of it ended up being quite a big part of like your life, kind of especially like in those childhood years, and then kind of, you know, leaking into like your university years as well?
Yeah, it's crazy because so theatre and drama was something that I remember it's all funny how like I would say God always places breadcrumbs in your life like that you just can't begin to pick up and you begin to follow. And for me, like, drama started as early as being in primary school in Zambia, and my first role was Joseph. You see, say primary school Joseph.
Right.
It was like the Christmas story, is there any room in the inn? And I was just like, that was my line. That was my one line. Is there any room in the inn? And I just had to say that three times and sit there and watch as Mary gave birth to this imaginary baby. And it was crazy because that again sparked something in me where I realized I like to perform and I like to be on stage, but that changed as I got older, and I explained why. And as my mom put me in these drama classes, these drama schools, I realized how much I liked acting and how acting and performing gave me such a buzz, even at that young age. But also seeing, I liked the applause. I liked people saying, oh my gosh, that was amazing. That was great. And it fed my ego. Because when I came here again, it was my way of getting validation and being accepted within London and the UK, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then when I realized that I was actually really good at it, I was like, okay, cool. I can keep going with this. And it's something that I can consistently enjoy. And so my mom was just like, you're good at it, keep going. And so that's basically my mindset. And then when I hit college was when I realized I was really good at it and I enjoyed writing and directing. So I got an A star in my GCSE. I got an A in my A level and a B. I did drama and performing arts. Wow. And then even going to uni, I remember going to uni and I was just like, I want to do music management. At that time, that's when I was deep in my music. I was like, yeah, you almost got nominated for a MOBO and that didn't happen. But then I was like, I want to be the next P. Diddy. I've seen how like all these people have made amazing life transformation, you know, MTV Cribs was on. And it's like, yeah, welcome to my crib, man. And I was just like, I want a big house like that. How do I get that? I need to be able to make music that's universal and that sells. And then I was just like, okay, cool. So I did arts management and I was like, I don't understand the business element. I know I can perform, I know I can rap, but let me understand the business element. And then when I got into uni, as I was filling out the application form, I realized how heavily theoretical it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to need an outlet to where I can just be silly and have fun. And that's the way I saw drama. Like, I'll just go be silly, have fun, read Shakespeare, a bit of Tolstoy and Bertolt Brecht and all of that stuff. And I'll just be like, okay, cool. Let me read a bit of this and just be funny and silly. And so that became my outlet. And then as I began to perform more and I got to uni, I realized that some people were great. They were great actors, but just needed somebody to tell them how to act and be better at what they do. And I realized I was a great actor, but I preferred telling people how to be better actors. And so then I was like, okay, so what does that look like? Okay, cool, I'm going to be a director. And so I stepped back off the stage and began to write and direct people to be like, you know, if you delivered it this way, you'd have more impact. And then the more that people began to trust my opinion and trust the way that I saw the stage and the lens, I began to delve into the psychology of human behavior and understanding why, like by picking up a cup or you slam a cupboard or you sit a certain way and you put all this behavioral influencing, which people now call NLP, has significantly impacted in the way that you're perceived. And so when I'm on stage or when I'm put actors on stage, for me, that was what I was doing. I like being able to get an actor to manipulate the audience to get an elicited response as exactly what I wanted. And I was like, this is great. And so that's where my passion really stems from, even from my coaching, understanding how I would say the only way you can be a really, really good actor is if you really understand yourself. And for me, that's the one thing I would encourage people to do. How well do you know yourself in order to manipulate yourself to be somebody else on stage that the audience believes that the person that they're seeing is not who you are?
Yeah.
And so that is like the joy of acting. That is it. And when people talk about method acting and they're like, oh, you have to become a completely other person, I'm just like, I don't necessarily agree with that principle, but that's something else, another conversation.
Yeah.
But it's such a big part of who I am. Like, I run a drama company, Flourish Drama. Pick them up. So, So, next production, I'll let you know. So, that would be dope, like, for you guys to come check it out. But it's just the idea of it became a business to me. And like I said, I did my first play in the middle of my dissertation. And we're talking about mental health now. My dissertation was on the Black Arts Movement and how it impacted the civil rights. And for me, that was like, okay, cool. And very present in regards to what's going on right now.
Yeah.
But I remember doing that and then writing 4,000 words of my dissertation and saying I'm finished because I thought I had said everything that I needed to say. And I took it to my lecturer. My lecturer was like, there's so much more that you could cover. And I was finding it difficult to fill that quota to the point where I was like, forget this, I'm going to do a play. And I ended up doing a play. And so I took all my experience that I had learned in 3 years. I was like, I hired a theater, got some actors, promoted it, did everything. And then we sold out and the venue sat like 365 people. And that was in the middle of doing my dissertation. And then I was like, okay, that gave me the emotional outlet that I need. Now let me begin to really focus on my dissertation. Did my dissertation, graduated from uni, and then literally carried on doing theater consistently ever since.
Yeah, so interesting. I guess it's such an emotive thing to delve into, I guess, with acting, and that I guess it has this form of expression that can be extremely powerful, right? So I can really imagine that.
I think, like, sorry, I was just going to add that I think that exactly what you said about the form of expression and it being powerful, because it then allows people to really experience, live vicariously through the character that they see on stage. Mm-hmm. And then that in itself allows people to reflect. I always say, one of my favorite mentors, he says that actors and actresses and the performing arts are prophets of the world, and all they do is shine a show a mirror. Yeah. All they do is hold up a mirror for them to see what society is like or could be. And so that in itself, again, is just, yeah, my thought.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You take Bad Boy for Life energy up to Leicester.
Is of course, baby, mom's up there. Oh my days. Yeah.
How did you find your time in the Midlands?
That was, Leicester is officially, I say Leicester is my third home. So Nottingham, loved Nottingham, graduated from uni, stayed in Nottingham, and then lived in Leicester for like 3 years. Leicester was amazing, man.
So that's where my dad was born and raised, Nottingham.
Mad!
Yeah, and then he moved back there when I was like 11 for probably like 7 years. So yeah, I know Nottingham quite well in terms of like going and seeing him. So that's really weird. Yeah. That's like a home of yours.
Yeah, listen, it's crazy. Alfreton Road. I remember living on Alfreton Road and realizing that it was the most ghetto part of Nottingham to live, because it was so cheap. I was like, okay, yeah, I can afford to live here. Yeah. Living on Alfreton Road, moving in, and I remember like my car was parked outside, and there was a bunch of mandem like dressed hoodies, all like chilling in the corner. And I was like, what the hell? Like, is this
yeah.
is this what I came to? I thought I was escaping all of this, but yeah.
You've obviously transitioned from Zambia to London, and mm-hmm. then London to the Midlands, and it's like three completely different cultures, I guess, growing up. How did you find the London to the Midlands one?
London, and so I went, yeah, exactly what you said. I took Bad Boys for Life up to Leicester, thinking there were no Bad Boys. Thinking there were no Bad Boys in Leicester. Boy, there's some Bad Boys in Leicester. I'll tell you that for free.
For real.
And I remember thinking, yeah, I could do gang. I could be up here. I could be with a man then. And then seeing all of that completely changed my perspective of the Midlands.
Mm.
I think the transition was interesting because London is very fast paced, very much, all right, we get it done. Moving to Leicester, it was just very slow. Yeah. Everyone, not very slow, but it was just, everyone's really chilled. And people could tell you're a Londoner. They were just like, oh, you're from London. And I was like, yeah, why? Oh, you got this swag. You got this energy.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, damn right. I got this energy. Yeah. Like, you need to know what I'm about. You know what I'm saying? And so, but that again, just made me realize how different people take that energy completely different. And it's not in a negative way or a positive way. It's either or. And so depending on who you meet and how you engage, changes the dynamic. And I think it was interesting, actually, enough, when I went to Leicester University, not Leicester, I went to De Montfort, but in Leicester was when I realized again the idea of being black, because I think encountering people that were from all over the UK who had not necessarily encountered a black person or someone that was like me, I'll never forget my first year of uni. I remember my first year of uni, I was like, yeah, I'm going to make, like, I'm just going to stick with the black people and I'm just going to be, you know, I'm going to like bring London to Leicester. Da, da, da. And then I got to second year and I was like, you know what? I need to open my eyes and understand that uni is an experience and it's about expanding your experiences. And I remember trying to make friends with people that weren't black or that weren't necessarily of a BAME background.
Mm.
And that completely backfired because that's when I realized how people had subtle biases and prejudices. So in the lecture room, I'll never forget this. In the lecture, they'll be like, oh, yeah, yeah. Then when they see me walking in the street, they wouldn't say hello to me. And I'm just like, hold on, like, what the hell, man? And then that really began to affect my own self-esteem, because then I was thinking, oh, I guess I'm not widely, because I'm a people person.
Mm.
And it's the idea that I guess I'm not widely accepted outside of my own community. And I need to somehow change that. And even when I began to change that, it was only people from, I realized I love Londoners. And I think it's just because of how we embrace everybody, regardless of race, creed. And even though we could get into political views of cross systems and all of that stuff and the, you know, the man and society, I think with most people, particularly millennials, have good intentions and a great heart and are willing to embrace everybody and anyone.
Mm.
And so that again was just something that I experienced just being up in Nottingham, Leicester. And then being in Nottingham was just, Nottingham is just like Croydon. I would say,
yeah, for real, for real.
try and create it is a mixture of people, not an individual. I can just say, yeah. You have one side where it's like you have council estates, and then on the other side, there's these amazing, like, flat, like, houses and mansions and gates and stuff like that, which is, can be created, plus the tram. So that was it,
Something that I learned about you through research more than actually just conversing with you is a society you were a part of at university. And I'd...
Oh, is that...
And you know what? This is like... I guess it's white privilege in a way. But I'd never heard of this society ever. Like, it just... When I saw it, I was like... I saw the letters in there and I was like, yo, what the fuck is this? Like, I just didn't know what it was. And then I read it and I was like, oh, okay, very cool. Like, super dope. Can you explain to people what ACS is and kind of how you found your way like into that society?
So the society is called the Afro-Caribbean Society. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a celebration of Black culture, Black heritage, and being African and Caribbean in the university. Mm-hmm. Because this is a known fact, like not a lot of Black families probably before that used to go to university and stuff like that. It was like, there's still even in this generation where you find I'm the first person to graduate from uni.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a thing, but all it was a place where people would come together and really discuss, celebrate, not discuss, but sometimes discuss, but celebrate our heritage and our culture and what it means to be Black in university and celebrate that with everyone else and just share that with the uni. How I found myself in there is that, funny enough, one of my friends, so I went to uni trying to escape some of my London hood friends, but thinking I'm going to bring that London hood energy by myself, not realizing a whole bunch of them followed, but we all went up together. And then one of the guys from ENDS, like from Peckham, he was the leader of the ACS society. So he was like he was the president. So every year you have a president, and he was the president of the society. And literally that's where I learned how to put on events. And it was amazing. So he was the president, and he took me under his wing, and we really started spending time together from the perspective of him finding his faith. So it was really interesting. So he helped me navigate through university in regards to understanding how I should behave and how I should be in approaching different scenarios, situations. And I helped him navigate, his faith and how he can express his faith to the wider world, etc. And that blossomed and grew into a really relationship. One of my best friends that I still have today, actually. Shout out Paul Payne. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, bang, bang. But what was interesting is that one of my favorite scriptures, it says that iron sharpens iron. So the countenance of a brother sharpens another. And it's just the idea that caused me to really take an interest in what it means to be Black within university, but not only just university, but wider society as a whole. Mm. So you're Black here, but how does the rest of the world see you? And so with that, when I was in second year, I became part of the media team. And I'll never forget, we went into ACS, and the previous ACS run out a ridiculous debt. So they're in the negative. And so every year the university sponsors societies and they give them money, but we were in the negative. And so the university refused to give us money. So we were like, okay, cool. We're just going to generate our own income. And by the time we ended that year, we were in the plus. So most of the societies kind of just break even by the end of the year. By the time we'd finished ACS that one year, we had $5,000 to give to the people that were coming up after us.
Wow.
And so the university looked at that and they were like, wow. And that year we had won Society of the Year because of the impact that we had in regards to the university as a whole. So really talking about Black culture, Black heritage, some of the events that we did that were huge and they were dynamic, but also just celebrating what it means to be Black in university and embracing your culture and your identity, that sort of thing. And so I encourage people to be involved. Even till today, actually, my closest friends are all from ACS. Like, even my missus, we served in ACS together. And, like, all my friends, like, all over the gaff, like, we all were part of this ACS team. And I encourage people consistently, like, understand, even, and most people assume that to be part of the ACS, you have to be Black. No, it's just a celebration of Black culture. Mm. Like, I know some people that are called African-Caribbean. I know some white Zimbabweans. One of the people that you interviewed actually was from Zimbabwe and they were white. And so it's the idea that all you're doing is celebrating your heritage and your history while sharing that with the rest of the university. So it was dope. Yeah. Super good research, dope. By the way, Lee Cobb, dude. No. Like, dope research, man.
Yeah, of course, man. It was important, you know. So, and it was a part of your story that I really appreciated because it's obviously, it's incredibly relevant now, like firstly, in terms of the time that we're living in now, I think it's like very vital to know why and know and to empower people to celebrate their blackness. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to strictly be Black Lives Matter. Like, there's a part of that sentiment I completely agree with, of course, as you know, but there's also a part where it's not just that they matter, but they need to be celebrated, right? And
dope,
you know what I'm saying? So it's not just...
Yeah, that's dope.
I appreciate establishing a baseline, but at the same time, for some of us that are very much there, the leap that I have to take is very different. It's...
Yeah.
It's, you know... And that's not because I'm better than anybody else, but because I have that perception and that's my baseline to... All of us need to improve as a white race in our perception. And I know there's some people that their baseline is lower than Black Lives Matter, so they need to get to there. And then for me, obviously, it comes to celebrating black voices, celebrating black people, embracing that culture, everything that it means. So for me anyway, it's an important part of your story because it's something that's relevant now, and also it's symbolic of the work that you've been doing for time. Like, it's not... there's also a big part of that. Like, it's not... that you've been using your voice for years. It's not, you know, it's not 2020 and you've just arrived in terms of
that
conversation, you know? So,
it
was important to me. So when I saw it through the research, I was like, I want to talk about
it. No, that's dope. I think, but you know what's so really, what I find interesting, Rico, is that the fact that not many people are like you in regards to your understanding and perception of the world and understanding humanity. And I think that's dope. That's a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
Like, your ability to take, I always say the most powerful thing that you can do whenever I'm coaching people is to be constantly inquisitive and ask questions and be curious about the other people and that sense of self-discovery and that innocence of where you approach things with an open heart and open arms allows you to learn more than it does when you actually just come thinking that you know everything. And that in itself for me is the recognition that you're showing there. It's just like, all right, yeah, I don't know everything. But what I do know is this and this. Now, how do I take it to the next level? How can I be enlightened? In this scenario, in this situation.
Thank you. And yeah, like you said, you end up, I believe that your production did a production of Roots. And you got people together about Flourish Production, as it's going to soon be known as. But how was it birthing that idea? Because it is almost a birth of an idea. And and how did you find, because I believe you said it was received with mixed, I guess, mixed emotions, maybe? Probably the best way of putting it. And it's something that I once again, it sat with me because it's this idea of having this idea and being, I can imagine you were extremely passionate about it, especially at the beginning. And how did it feel to have a mixed reception to an idea that you clearly loved?
Crushed, mate. I was absolutely crushed.
Yeah.
When I tell you. So what happened was, imagine in the middle of doing our dissertation, and most of my friends are in third year. So we're all third year, second year. Shout out to Ebs as well, Eben Ali.
Yeah, big shout out to
one of the people that I sat down. Yeah, she's dope. And we've been friends ever since, like, not even because of that, but she's just an amazing, a wonderful person.
Yeah.
But we were sat, so I gathered 12 of my friends. So ACS had finished. And then afterwards, I had an idea for a play. And then I gathered 12 of my closest friends and 12 people that I thought you guys would actually, if we did this together, would, like, kill the whole theater scene in the Midlands, would be amazing, like, would go global, all of that stuff. So I had this vision. This would emphasize and reflect everything that I believe drama to be, especially for black and ethnic minorities, and not even just black ethnic minorities, but just people that are never given the chance or the platform to perform or a space to actually, you know, because theatre is very much a very white middle class thing, and you usually say the same actors, blah blah blah. And I just wanted to give everyone that grew up on ends like me, black, white, the opportunity to be able to be on stage. And so went to my friends, I got them in the room, and it was like 6 in the afternoon. I sat them around. I was like, guys, so what I'm thinking is I want to start a drama company and I want to call it Flourish. And I was hella nervous. Like, I was proper nervous. I was like, oh, my days. And then literally the moment I said Flourish, everybody laughed. Not even like, not as in everybody laughed. These are my friends. And I was like, crushed. And they were just like, oh, no, because what, it's so funny. Even Evlof, like, you know, where you keep, like, people are trying to keep a straight face. So I'm like pouring my heart out. It's the vision that I have for the company and da 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 da. And I want to call it Flourish. They all started laughing. And then afterwards, what happened was that six of them moved away and the other six stayed. Right. And so they all walked away. Those six, though, they gave their excuses and said, nah, it's not for me. They left. And then the six that stayed, I looked at them and I was like, all right, cool. Are you guys with me? And they were just like, oh, all right, cool. We'll do it with you, but we don't see this going anywhere. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But fast forward now 10 years. And we've had a number of sold out productions in different venues, learned a lot along the way in regards to understanding the business. Again, like I think I always say, I spent the first 5 years doing Flourish. So once I graduated from uni, living in Nottingham, that was me working out whether I want to pursue it or not. I spent the first 5 years being extremely creative. Like I'm just going to do plays. I'm going to make them amazing. And people are going to come and they're going to walk away and they're going to be like, wow, wow, wow. And which did that really well. Spent the following 5 years trying to understand the business of this and how to make it sustainable with all the pitfalls, doing productions, losing money, doing productions, selling out, but not getting the credibility that I, or the notoriety that I wanted, as well as the recognition. Because I think it's important. I think recognition gives you a publicity, and that's what you need, especially in theatre and stuff like that, because you have so many shows in the West End, and the UK has such a rich heritage of theatre. I think it's something that we take for granted and should be explored further, especially within the fringe theatre space. And I think for me, what I want to do is really I want to, again, continue to celebrate that and really with Flourish, despite those people walking away. I still talk to them today and they always ask me, how's Flourish going? I'm like, oh, yeah, it's going great. We're doing this, we're doing that. And I've learned, it taught me so much about myself, around people management, around dealing with individuals and how to grow something. Because I think we're the millennial generation where we want everything done instantly. And we think that it's just overnight successes are what we celebrate. But this grind has been so arduous and so long, but it's something that I'm deeply passionate about, especially allowing people to express their talents and actually be on stage and do their thing. Like, yeah, for me, that's it. So that was disheartening at the time. But now I'm just like, I can go again. Second win, let's go. Let's go.
whilst you're setting up Flourish and everything's going there, you transition into coaching work.
Yeah.
How did you, I guess with Flourish, you kind of had a bit of, I guess, some experience with like, I guess, self-employment / freelancing. But in terms of your coaching, where it's more career-based, in terms of that, that being your profession, how did you find that? I guess transitioning from what I would call conventional like working circumstances to a more freelance kind of self-employment based work.
So how that came about was really interesting, actually. I remember in the drama company, I was thinking, I saw the correlation between teaching people how to act and how to deliver speeches. And I was like, there must be somebody that gets paid to teach people how to deliver a speech, because it's the same principle. The only difference is I'm not focusing in on your artistic integrity and all of that stuff. And the like, do you know what I mean? But all I'm doing is focusing on your ability to deliver a speech and do it well. And so what happened was, I approached my drama company. At this moment, we had like board members, and I was like, all right, board, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm thinking of taking, of shifting, not only doing drama, but a good way to make income would actually be coaching people how to deliver speeches and stuff like that. And then the board were like, nope, this doesn't make sense. Let's just focus on the performing arts. It takes too much energy and it takes too much time. And I was like, no, it doesn't, because we could run it alongside the drama company, and they just weren't having it. So then afterwards, I was like, you know what? Screw you guys. I'm going to do it by myself then. And then I went off and started doing body language and communication. So started doing a bit of studies around behavioral science, did a few short courses, understanding the neural processes and how our brain works, and then seeing the correlation in regards to behavior influencing and theatre. And I matched those along and I was like, great, I now have a program that I can begin to roll out and teach people. And I remember I worked with this other company for like, before starting up my own coaching company, I literally worked with this other guy who was like an ex-actor. So he is a failed actor. He was an ex-failed actor. And he was just like, yeah, this isn't working for him. And he did the same thing. So I was with him for 6 months. And 6 months, I'll never forget, I 10x his income based on my ability of understanding business, branding, and like networking, that sort of thing. Because that's something that I am good at, which is business and branding and networking. And so then what happened was that I ended up winning this amazing contract with Microsoft, after winning this amazing contract with Microsoft, won like another one with two big brands, and that made him so much money. And then after that, I was just like, okay, cool. I've done that with him. Let me now build that for myself. And so we had an amicable separation. Yeah. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And then literally started my own coaching company. And I've been doing that ever since. And so I've worked with so many amazing organizations, from HSBC, currently working with, as a contracting with another organization, working with Tesco and a whole bunch of different brands, just coaching people, not only on body language communication, but now the idea of growth mindset, and also understanding how the future of work looks like, and how we can all be leaders within the workspace, and all these other things, like anti-bias and cultural awareness training. And this is all just part of my life experiences, plus understanding the process of coaching and training, as well as studying to show yourself approved, which is something that I've done.
Has that been empowering for yourself, knowing that you're giving people that skill set?
100%. I think it's given me more focus, but also meant that I've learned a lot along the journey that I've had to implement for myself. Rather than me just, you have to practice what you preach, right? And so if people are looking at me and they're just like, oh yeah, he talks about this, he talks about that, but he's really not exhibiting a lot of the attributes and the qualities that he's talking about, then that makes me a hypocrite and just a performer, as opposed to somebody that's living a lot of this. I think the one thing that I've learned, like I talked about Brené Brown, one thing that I've learned from Carol Dweck is just the idea of resilience and having deep emotional intelligence, understanding that growth mindset is not just the idea of, okay, yeah, I've done this and it's failed, I'm just going to move on. But okay, why has it failed? How can we overcome it? What are the different ways to overcome it? As opposed to, I failed and I'm never going to try again. Because I've failed at so many different things in life. As much as I talk, it's funny, I was driving and I'm having this thought. I feel like people think, and this is just my personal opinion, but I feel like people think that I don't have to try for things, but they don't understand how much effort I do, or effort I put in order to make things work. Because a lot of the time it appears that things come easy to me. Oh yeah, like, oh great, you got this opportunity, that's great. But it's the grafting that I've had to do in order to get that. And so recently I had three big L's that I'm not legally allowed to talk about. Three big L's that would have like taken everything to the next level in regards to my profession, some of the opportunities that I could be getting. As well as just like my state of being. Like I would have been like, I'd have been flexing and everyone like, yeah, check me out, keep walking. But they were so big that it actually knocked me back for a second. And I was just like, and I remember talking to my partner about this, and I was just like, yo, like, bro, like I actually took them some big L's here, and there's nothing that I can do to fix it or change it. And then her response was, oh, it's great that you're still, at least you're having those conversations. And I was just like, yeah, I guess so, but that's not the point. Do you know what I mean? I want to win, like, yeah. You know what I mean? But then when you don't win, how do you deal with the rebound? And so to me, that's something that technically right now I'm still getting over, if I'm honest. I'm still like getting over it, but I know it's one of those ones where like, okay, cool, the next opportunity will come and I have to just grab onto it and hold onto it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, bro, so, I took some L's in like January and February that still don't feel crazy. Like they've scabbed over, like for real.
It's a lot, man.
And I actually posted about this for the like on Instagram about the podcast like 2 days ago, in terms of this idea of, I think people, they hear the podcast for me and they think that it's just the conversation, and I don't think I thought about it, I guess, a bit more in recent time, but bro, these podcast episodes take me like, I said 12 hours an episode, but that was like low. And you know what I mean, in terms of like I remember editing one episode and getting it completely wrong and having to re-edit it, so it ended up taking me just like 10 hours on editing alone. So yeah, I can completely empathize and relate to this idea of, I think people maybe we take in what the final product is and we don't even really contemplate like what it's taken to get there. And like you said, and like you said earlier, I'm like a big believer in this, like we're in this society that really, we've spoken about it in terms of, we really crave immediacy, right? In terms of results, in terms of everything. So it's almost hard to fathom that someone's had to put in an actual graft to get to where they are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, and I completely think agree.
It's mad. Yeah, it's mad because people, like, I know nepotism is real, but some of us actually have to graft. Like, yeah. We literally have to put the work in order to make things happen. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah, it's mad. Completely agree. Mm-hmm. A tweet of yours that you posted recently stuck with me.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear this.
So, I'm going to read the tweet. I'd just like for you to speak to it. But
okay, cool.
So, from the words of Tambo, last week, I was concerned that I don't promote the work that I do enough. Despite working with household names and getting paid, I was so in my feelings. Then I listened to an interview by Carl Locker. That just shifted me out of my insecurities and emotions. I came to the conclusion I'd rather be unknown to the masses, but in my place and in place of influence and significance, than known and not having a real impact or influence. And I thought that, especially the secondary part of that tweet, is something that I very much feel for myself personally. But what was your thought behind in terms of that sentiment and that kind of realization? And how was it to kind of have that realization?
So how did I come to that realization? Let me address the how. I just come back. So the second L, I just received the second L and I'm like, oof, that's a lot. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And so then afterwards, I was sitting down and I was in my feelings and I was like, oh, maybe I should start promoting myself a bit more. Maybe if I have a bigger platform and a bigger profile, these people recognize that I am actually experienced enough to do well. Blah, blah, blah. And so I started thinking about all the things that I wasn't doing and thinking about all the other people that they post. Oh yeah, I've just done this. I've just done that. And they promote a whole bunch of stuff that they're celebrated for. And I was like, maybe people should celebrate me more and that allow me to get the recognition that I want, that I deserve. And at that moment, I was being very much, I, you guys need to look at me. Like, everyone else is talking about this stuff, but I've been doing this for years. Look at me kind of thing. And that was the child in me screaming for attention.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I realized that, hold on. And then I paused for a second. I was like, okay, but let's really look at these opportunities that these people get. And if they're getting paid, good on them. But you've been getting paid for years. Mm. And your voice is someone that, yeah, even though you're not, may not be known to the masses, I sit in rooms where my opinion is heard, and most importantly, it actually makes a difference. So now that I sit in those rooms, would I rather trade that to be somebody that's on social media, has like 20,000 followers, and just saying a whole bunch of rubbish, but not really making a difference? Yes, I'm heard, and some people are like, yeah, but it's taken lightly. Or be somebody that's in the boardrooms, in the meetings, really saying and making a difference and speaking truth to power and seeing the difference that it's making. And then I was just like, I'd rather be that guy. And so what that has done has it's focused me and allowed me to really step away from just being an immature little brat, wanting to be noticed and wanting to sing and dance so everybody can be celebrated. But that won't necessarily make me happy. Not even won't necessarily, it definitely won't make me happy. Because I've learned something about myself over the years as well, that I'm an extrovert. I'm very much an extrovert and an introvert, but I'm an extrovert that likes to, I don't like unnecessary attention. Right. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So like, and a good example would be if just saying we are out somewhere and then all of a sudden someone says, oh, Tambo, I'd love for you to give a speech. And I'm like, what the hell? No, leave me alone. I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? But then like the conversation that we're having now, if somebody was just like, oh yeah, we're going to have this conversation. There's going to be like 20 people listening to the convo. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I can manage that, because then I'm managing the attention that's given to me as opposed to it just being, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I say that to say it is literally just liberating. It's allowed me to mature in a different way and focused me saying, stay in your lane and keep going. Forget what everyone else is saying. Forget all of like the expectations that you might have but the expectation of being celebrated for the work that you do, because sometimes it won't. And even when it isn't, you keep going anyway, because you are making a difference and you're making a tangible difference that can be seen. So, yeah.
Super profound. Yeah. Super profound.
Yeah, man. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, I love that message. I'm not going to step on it. I'm just going to let that sit and breathe. So we met through Mentality and I looked back and I was like, when was it? So it was Feb
2018. 2018. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So Can you?
At the Collective, I remember. Yeah.
I feel like you would do us a, you would do Mentally a better service by explaining it more so than me. So can you explain to people what Mentality is and the role that you've played there, especially around that time? I guess more so is, I'm assuming it's kind of evolved since, but kind of when I met you at that time, the role that you were playing in that team.
Yeah, so Mentality is a men's mental health and well-being platform specifically aimed at allowing men to have better conversations at work, at home, and in life, and actually live a better life in general. As you know, the suicide rate is a lot higher between men and women. The suicide rate is obviously higher for men. We're not saying that it's that all lives matter thing. It's not that we're saying that women's lives are irrelevant, but it's the rate of suicide that happens with black men. And not even just black men, I said black men, but specifically black men, but also the wider demographic. Mm. And that's exactly what we look at with Mentality. Now, Mentality, interestingly enough, was started by Ebbs Ali, the heart stylist, which she's amazing. She recently calls me a co-founder, but at the same time, I'm just like, I don't know if I'm ready for that title yet. But, you know, I think what she does is amazing. Like, and I'm just like, yeah, she's the boss. And I think it all was birthed out of her seeing some of her male friends have no one to talk to. And then she came to me and she started Mentality. Then she came to me and she was like, Tambo, I'm thinking of starting this thing. Like, I want to do it. Like, I'm going to do it. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure, start it. And I didn't expect her to start it. And then she started it and it built so much traction. And I was like, I definitely want to be involved. Like, and she was like, that's the reason why I came to speak to you in the first place. So, you'd be involved. Really, I think what we do, our focus is, again, allowing men to have better conversations, even like the conversation that we have now, allowing us to be open and honest and really be, let me put it this way, be in pursuit of happiness and well-being and just to be okay. I think a lot of the time what happens is that we get stifled in our communication and we bottle up our emotions and our feelings, and then that causes us to implode. But there are a lot of men that are imploding that don't have the opportunity, if all they had was somebody to share their feelings with or somebody to hug or say it's going to be okay, can really shift and transform a man's mind. And so for what we're trying to do, and I remember when we first did our first Mentality Live event in 2018, it was huge, it was dope. And we were just like, I remember saying to Ed that by 2020, I want to reach at least 10,000 men and literally have a conversation around that. Very ambitious, I know, like, let's reach 10,000 men. I think we've probably reached about 2,000, maybe 3,000, which is still a lot. Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is really allow people to have these open and honest conversations through events, through Instagram lives that we do, through workshops. And so my part in that time specifically was just framing it and allowing Ebbs to grow the vision and literally allow to breathe life into it. And I was just like, okay, cool. All I'm doing is supporting you. Breathe life into it. And as she's done that, my role has evolved now to the point of really thinking about it strategically, the growth of Mentality, and also thinking about how we can impact the world in a positive way. And once we impact the world in a positive way, specifically for men, if you touch men's hearts, they can begin to shape society. Because I know we're all about 50-50 and equality, but we still live in a patriarchal world. But imagine if I could touch those men on those people to actually think in a balanced way and give a balanced perspective in regards to how they view themselves and the world in itself. It will actually allow for more equality, regardless of race, sex, gender, creed, anything like that. And so Mentality in itself is there to allow men to have these conversations, to breathe, reflect, and then think how they can have a positive impact in the society that they live in.
Yeah. Firstly, I'm glad I let you explain, because you did explain it far better than I would have.
a bit long-winded, I'm sorry.
No. It was just better, objectively. So with everything that's happened with the recent conversation around the Black Lives Matter movement and with May 25th, which were the two incidents of George Floyd's murder, which is something that we know as a big society, but I guess the underlying story, which probably speaks more to covert racism, which depending on where you stand could be equally as prolific and detrimental to the black community, is the Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper phone call / interaction. Depending on your perception, I think one's very blatant and in your face. The other one is one that we see too often, and almost is symbolic of the Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper situation can often lead to the George Floyd incident and the 110%. Result. So
110%.
As much as you're comfortable speaking about, how have you found not only the emotional processing of both of those incidents, but also, I guess, the work that you've done and everything you've done in terms of uplifting Black men and Black women and everything that comes along with that? How have you found that conversation? How have you found the emotional, I guess, response to what you had to see in that case? And I guess finally, how has it changed your perception, I guess, with the conversations happening? How have you felt in response to everything that's been happening?
So first of all, I think it's interesting the fact that both of their last names were Cooper. Because that, and again, speaks of the mind. Like, there is no greater irony in life than the fact that this white woman was snitching on this Black man and creating a scenario where it was not the case to be. Because literally, that's how slaves were killed during the space, during slavery. Because literally, that again, literally, the white woman would cry rape, and then all of a sudden the Black man is castrated, or he's killed, or he's beaten, or severely wounded. That was a perfect example. And the fact that obviously we know the history of slavery and how Black people get their last names, Cooper, ironically, like, there is no greater irony. When we talk about, I know before we're talking about religion and coincidences, I don't think it's definitely not a coincidence.
No.
It's definitely not a coincidence. And what, like, I feel that what God was doing, or even in that moment, what that moment does is shine a light on the covert racism and the systematic oppression that has been affecting us for years that we've been unable to speak about. And then moments when we thought, because we talk about these moments within Black community and we think, oh, maybe it's just in my head, but this is actually showing it's not just in your head. It is the microaggressions. It is the attacks of, it's something that we've been seeing over and over again. So even like the civil injustice and the things that have been happening. So the example that I can give you is Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
Trayvon Martin getting killed in 2012. That in itself, again, I like a young Black man walking down the street carrying some Skittles.
Yeah.
And then you see all the different things of how the emotional processing of it was. At first I was like, okay, I don't know how I can deal with this. And when at first you kind of, you know, it's there. But the moment now that it's on camera, especially when you see everything that's happened with George Floyd, you see that happening on camera and you're just like, this is emotionally soul destroying. I can't jump in the camera and stop the person from doing it because I know it sounds horrible. My immediate response is to, it's so funny. I always say I flex between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and my immediate response is to be Malcolm X. By any means necessary, I'm going to kill you. You hit me, I'm going to hit you back. But the part of me realizes that that doesn't cause a raised fist do not cause peace. Mm. At the moment, like me and you, I raise my fist and we start throwing blows and we start punching out each other. One of us is going to get hurt, but that doesn't solve the problem because that doesn't alleviate the hate that you have in your heart or the anger that you have in your heart. So then how do we begin to deal with this? And for me, what I began to do, like, and I've always done this before, is call out racism when I see it, but I've become more bold in my stance, whereas before I would be like, oh yeah, okay, we need to, that was racist and I think it's important. I'll be like, no, that was bloody racist.
Yeah.
Like, where before I'd like kind of sugarcoat it and nice it down, but now whenever I see racism, I call it out. And I think that's exactly what we need to do. And it's not a now thing, it's a consistent thing. Because what I used to do is I would just whisper that within my community, oh bro, that was racist. And I'll be whispering it. But now I'm like, yo, like, this is racist. Do you know what I mean? And rather than, and looking at what, and I like the fact, I like and I dislike the term white allies. And the reason why is that they shouldn't be white allies. We shouldn't just say, oh, because you're white, you're an ally. Do you know what I mean? That means they're actually enemies out there. And I completely understand that they are people that are working against the system, what we're trying to de-systemize and de-establish. But I think it's important that we recognize that all human beings should be allies, regardless of Black, white, da 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 da. And as a white ally, you're using your white privilege to change the system. However, let's begin to address the fact that this person has white privilege anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though they're using it for the good of everything, it's the idea that that shouldn't even be part of the conversation. how about we just be justified in our approach to actually be like, do you know what? Let's actually deal with the issue rather than having to rely on other white people to speak on our behalf. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, we should be able to speak for ourselves. And so I think the whole emotional processing of this has been difficult to handle because all it does is put a magnifying glass on the fact that we still live in a world where it's unfair and unjust. Mm. And that's a difficult thing. Like, despite the fact that we're in 2020, these years where we thought we'd have flying cars and like teleporting machines growing up and all of that stuff, like, we are living the future. And at this rate, if change doesn't happen, I was watching the police assistant commissioner yesterday on BBC News, and he turned around and said, how do you define black? And I was outraged and appalled by that statement. And he was like, what do you mean? How do you define black? And I was like, if I was to ask you, how do you define white? How would you answer that question? If I turn around and said, define your whiteness, that in itself, again, is a problematic statement, because it speaks of the system and the institution that has been established, that you are the assistant commissioner of the Met Police. And at your ripe old age of how many years of experience, because he boasted initially at the beginning of the interview, I've got 31 years of experience. And after 31 years of experience, you cannot define the term black. There's an issue.
Mm.
There is an issue. And so for me, what that does, it just makes me angry. And it's frustrating because this is not the London that I understand to be. Yeah. But I understand also these systems and these processes. And as I get older, I'm just like, I'm trying to work my way into positions of influence and power. But I'm like, oh, I can't get there because I'm not white. Oh, I don't know the right person. Oh, I didn't go to the right school. And all those are blockers. And it's like, oh, do you know what? It's not even because you didn't know the right person. It's not because you went to the white school. Right school. I said white. But it's just because you're not white.
Yeah.
That's the fact. It was a Freudian slip, but I'm a great in there.
Yeah.
And so it's mad. It's mad. I think the emotional, again, taking it back, the way to deal with this, if I had a solution in regards to black people and speaking to my white allies, even though I said I don't like the term, yeah. I would say speak truth to power, but also at the same time, begin to realize that there is injustice everywhere. And that injustice shouldn't be the be all and end all of how we view the world and how we perceive ourselves. Let's fight, man. Like, every time there's been an uprising, every time there's been a moment to stand up and speak truth to power and really begin to call out the things that are not right in this system, in this environment, we've done it and we've done it well. Like, there's no people that are more resilient and no, not even more resilient. Yeah, there's not a people that are more resilient than that of the human spirit. And I realized I didn't say it's not just white people, it's not just black people. When we look at the Jews and how they were oppressed initially, it was the resilience of the human spirit. They were like, we're not going to stand for this. Black people, slavery, we're not going to stand for this. Even when we look at the wars that have happened for generations and centuries, where there have been injustice and systems that have been put to oppress one sort of man to another, it's the moment that you turn around and say, we're not going to stand for this, and unite in a united front. Nah, there's nothing that can stop us, man. Ain't nothing that can stop us.
I love that. I love that so much.
Yeah.
And I have loads of different thoughts, but I am sensitive of time. I've taken a lot of your time.
No worries, man.
Before I ask you to plug everything and to get to the final four questions, I would like for you to maybe speak some stuff into existence as much as you want to reveal / delve into this question. What are your personal hopes / dreams as we transition out of the Rona lockdown?
I think... what my hopes and dreams, like, as we transition out of the Rona lockdown, is that we take some of the lessons that we've learned during this period and begin to implement them and realize the importance of relationship, the importance of having good energy and good people around you in order to live better and holistic lives. I think what's happened during this Rona lockdown is that we've taken it back to the old school thinking of I am my brother's keeper. And I think that's something that we need to consistently live by and abide by. I think that's the after me coming to. I think, like, even simple things like clapping for the NHS showed a system of unity and actually understanding that people in those that support and help the weak are not necessarily low skilled or low paid workers, but they are actually significant to the progression of society as a whole. I think being able to call out racism and injustice is something that I want more people to begin to do. And most importantly, create opportunities for everybody that is qualified. Mm. Now, and they should not be disqualified based on the color of their skin, but based on literally, you know, like Martin Luther King, based on the merit of their character. What does the merit of your character say? And what does the merit of the work that you do speak of? Where the one thing I want to stop doing is giving spotlights to people that are just celebrities and give people spotlights to the people that really deserve a microphone and have something of substance to say. I want to see a world where I want to see a world where we literally begin to not only strive for excellence, but strive to be better people, strive for understanding, strive to really to love one another in a way that you live for your brother. And that's the only way I can think of it. It rhymes.
I love it. Right, Tambo, please plug everything in terms of what is forthcoming, where people can find you are the two main ones I'm thinking.
So what's forthcoming? So Drama Company, A Flourish Production, like I said, we've done this whole rebrand. So right now, when you guys see this, we probably would have launched, hopefully, fingers crossed, by the time you see this, we'd have launched our new logo. You'd be like looking at this amazing design that we're doing. We've got our website that's up. So if you go to aflourishproduction.com or aflourishproduction.co.uk, or just go on our Instagram and you'll find A Flourish Production. You'll find us there. What else? We've got a play, Regina, which talks about, which is really interesting. I don't want to spoil it too much, but go on the website. You see all of that stuff. And what we're trying to do, at this moment in time is we're trying to raise funds. And rather than actually going to the Arts Council, what we're doing is we're doing like a crowdfund. And it's just to sponsor the next production. By adding or giving to this crowdfund, what that happened is that it will propel us forward so that it will not only be able to produce this play, but the next production as well. As you know, the arts have been significantly affected by Rona, and it's literally crippled a lot of what we've been able to do. However, by you guys supporting and giving, it will make a significant difference to what we can achieve, especially within the arts and black arts in itself. And when I say black theatre, like, you, if you have never experienced the real black theatre production, and I say real black theatre production, not the contemporary stuff that you see in the old Vic and it's ooh, prim and polished, but it's prim, it's polished, but it's narratives and stories that you guys will be laughing your ass off at. So make sure you check that out. Where can you find me? You can find me on Twitter and Instagram of just_Tambo. That is me on all social media platforms. The reason I always say I'm just Tambo is because I'm just myself. And there's nothing more, nothing less. Everything that you see is who I am. So hopefully you guys can share, you guys can connect with me, and we can continue to have these conversations.
I love it. And awesome. Everything that Tambo's just explained is living in the show notes. So please check them out. Tambo, also send me the link for the crowdfunding thing at some point.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate it, man. Luca, you've been amazing, man. Let me not even interrupt. Like, this is the longest that we've talked in ages. However, it's been dope, bro. It's been awesome.
Yeah, I've loved it. Final four questions. So one of them's changed. These are, I would say, the deeper questions, but our conversation's obviously quite naturally gone there anyway. So I guess they're deeper in terms of thought more than anything else. Mm-hmm. But one has changed, which is one that you may haven't heard, but the and it is the first of the four. So first one, Tambo, if I was to give you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could share one message, what would it be?
Ooh. So I think if I had a megaphone to the rest of the world, it would be, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him to not perish but have everlasting life. Love your brother as you love yourself.
Love that. I love that. Number two. What's your biggest personal struggle that not many people know about?
Dealing with my insecurities and knowing that I am enough consistently rather than having to try. Yeah.
I love it. So,
okay.
What are three personality traits / characteristics that you'd say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Integrity, honesty, and love.
My man.
Integrity, honesty, and love. My man. That one I knew. You see how quick I was able to roll that one up?
Yeah, you were like, yeah, let me just freestyle this quick. So the final question. It's one of my favorite questions. It probably is my favorite question, but many years into the future, your time as Tambo Solavwe is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has one sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
I would say that he was a voice on a platform for this generation that loved God, loved people, and served his family.
I love that. That's perfect. Thank you so much, Tambu. Yeah, it is the longest conversation we've had in quite some time, and I always appreciate talking to you. So this has been like...
No problem.
This has been personally satisfying as well as just great to have on the podcast. Man. Yeah, I'm gonna say goodbye to everyone. So let's say goodbye. Cool. Take it easy, everyone.
Thank you so much. Easy.